Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude. If it's Friday, it must be Texas. If it must be Texas, it must be Scott Braddock, the editor of The Quorum Report, the dean of the Austin Press Corps, a guy who has just marveled us with his knowledge of Texas and Texas politics. Welcome back to the program, Mr. Braddock.
It must be Arnie Arneson calling me.
Of course. Who else would be shuffling
hello.
You know what? Exactly, exactly.
How's New Hampshire? Hello.
Tulsi Gabbard, I hear, is moving to New Hampshire. I wonder how that's going to work.
Tell me about that. Well, what is she doing?
I don't know, but I think it didn't work for Kamala in Iowa.
Oh.
So, ouch.
Whenever Arnie, what do you think about this whole idea of guys like Castro and Kamala and the way all this has gone for the candidates of color? You know, that they're complaining that you have these very white states right up front. Iowa, New Hampshire. I know you have to feel some way about this.
Well, that's
and they're saying that, and I do have a take on this. I wonder what you think. Grade my paper, Arnie.
Okay,
it seems
paper.
To me like it's not so much a function of those states being so white, although that's probably part of it. But I do think that the Democratic Party has sort of made this deal with the media, and I was trying to figure out if it's more of a concession to the media, or if the chairman Tom Perez, if he just sort of demanded, like, having so many debates and the way the rules are set up for the debates. It's what has led to the winnowing of the field to just basically white liberals and some white moderates, right? Because you don't have as much emphasis on the one-to-one conversations in those early states. It's all about national polling, fundraising, you know, whether you're going to be on the stage and all of that, rather than going to the diner in Concord.
So let me just say something. You know, you heard me say this about a year ago. I said a year ago, Biden and Bernie should not run. Let me repeat this. It's now 2019. I will say
it
again. Well, and that's part of the reason why the field has been so winnowed out. Bernie is sort of continuing to build on what he did in 2016 because he was the alternative to Hillary Clinton. He had a head start, and he resonates incredibly well with young people, more so than virtually any other candidate on the stage. And he has a relationship and allegiance and a sense of commitment to them. Plus, he really represents their progressive values. Biden, of course, has then sort of stepped in, and Biden is sort of becoming sort of Obama light, literally. I hate to say this, but it's made it very difficult, therefore, for other people to have a relationship with the black community. And that has nothing to do with Iowa, has nothing to do with New Hampshire, has nothing to do with white states. It has to do with the old white men that continue to think that they should, you know, continue to participate when they should be sitting on the sidelines and being statesmen. Throw into that mix Kamala, who never really developed a message. I mean, that's her issue. It was very, very weak. I don't understand why Cory Booker isn't resonating, because I think he's one of the best and most articulate speakers. He may not be my favorite, but I would have a top three, and he would clearly be there. Castro, oh my God, Castro is so thoughtful, and much to my surprise, given what you've sort of told me about the twins, that I think he really has offered a lot, but for whatever reason, he hasn't been able to resonate. And I think one of the reasons is that the top issues have been health care and have been climate change, and he really is seen as the immigration guy. And as a result,
and, you know,
that just doesn't resonate.
We talked about that, Arnie, right? You're tooting your horn, and you should. Let me toot mine for a second. Okay. Remember what I said about Castro was that on immigration, because remember, for a little bit there, it was the top issue, you know, and Castro sort of had his moment with that.
Right.
But what we said here on this show was that if you talk immigration, then you are doing what? Exactly what was warned against in Art of War. You don't meet your opponent on the battlefield that they choose.
Exactly.
And immigration is the issue that Trump wants to talk about.
Exactly.
And quite frankly, look at the polls. We've talked about this.
Right.
It's just not a top issue for Democrats.
No.
It's one of those things where if you press Democrats about whether they agree with the path to citizenship and all that, they'll say yes. But if you ask them what's their top issues, it's nowhere close to the top.
And so, again, it's in a lot of ways, those two old white men sort of sucked the energy out of the room and made us not really look at the new bench. And there really is a new bench out there. And yet you've got a couple of billionaires who are now going to appear on the stage. Well, that feels really uncomfortable on the Democratic side of the aisle. You have Andrew Yang, and Andrew Yang is a person. He's an Asian. So let's remember that there is a little bit of diversity here. And then you've got Mayor Pete. He is diversity, too, because he's the first openly gay person person to run for president.
So there is
a bit of diversity here, but most of the diversity has been drained out because of Biden and Bernie. I'm going to be honest with you. That's where it came from. And if they were not in the race, that would change. And the really unfortunate thing is to see what's happening with Tom Steyer and Mayor Bloomberg. This is the rub on so many levels because they are Steyer already bought his way into the debates. Bloomberg doesn't even need a debate. He wants his own private debate. It's called his public advertising campaign, and that is his strategy. I will outspend you by hundreds of millions of dollars. I will package as if I am the next coming of the Biden better. He'll be Pete better. He'll be everybody better from a moderate perspective. And to a large extent, because the moderates are so split, he actually, I think, does emerge.
Interesting. Well, we'll see what happens here. In the meantime, there's so much anger about the way this is playing out.
It is kind of shocking. But this morning, everyone, we tape on Thursday, and this morning, if you were listening Thursday morning, Nancy Pelosi did have a very short, somber press conference. She did not take, I believe, any questions from the media.
It was a statement.
It was a statement.
It's not really a press conference. No. If you don't take questions. But yeah.
Thank you very much. But the press was
thought.
Right. They all had their hands up. It just didn't work. Anyway, but what she basically said is, "We're pulling the trigger. We're basically writing the impeachment."
Oh, she ordered the chairman to move forward. Write articles of impeachment. It's a historic moment. No matter what you think of it.
And it was so interesting that the decision was after the professors. Not a witness was called. Everybody was sort of thinking, how many weeks would this happen? What would the judiciary be? Could could the chairman hold it together the way Adam Schiff could hold it together? And it turned out that Adam Schiff was the entire dog and pony show. Then it was rolling out the professors and bang, we're done. It's kind of shocking in a lot of ways.
You know, they're just moving so quickly with this. Everything is so polarized. Everything is so political. And I've got all of these brand new, newly minted constitutional scholars on my Facebook and Twitter who are explaining to me how this is not constitutional and the Congress can't do this. My redneck reading of the Constitution is, by the way, people should Google this, read a lot about it, find some articles about what's called plenary power. Okay, these are, as you know, Arnie, as a former member of a legislative body, when something is delegated by the foundational document to a certain branch of the government,
Congress.
That means that they have the sole power to do that, and they have the power to decide the way that they do it. Right. So, for example, when the legislature in Texas or in New Hampshire would pass a law, of course, that's in their power to do that, but the courts can still review whether that law is constitutional.
Right.
But what the court would not do, would never do, is interfere in the way that they got there. Right? They wouldn't say that their hearings were done incorrectly. They wouldn't say that the way they did their floor votes was done incorrectly. Courts are not going to weigh into that because there are certain things that are for the courts, certain things are for the legislative branch, certain things are for the executive. I was looking this up yesterday because it's fascinating. You know that the president has the sole power of pardons and commutations,
right?
With two exceptions. And this makes the point about why it's right in Congress's authority to do what they're doing. Whether people agree with it or not, it'll be up to the voters to decide whether they agree with it, right? Because the executive's not the only one vested with power from the voters. So are the members of Congress, the 535 who are on Capitol Hill. The ones in the House have the sole power of impeachment. The ones in the Senate have the sole power to have the trial about what's in those articles of impeachment, right? When it comes to pardons and commutations, there are two limitations on that sole power. And this is laid out in the Constitution. One is the president is not allowed to commute or pardon someone who has been convicted of a crime against the United States. That would be like a terrorist, for example. And the other limitation is they're not allowed to pardon someone if it would affect an impeachment proceeding. And the reason is they didn't want those things to overlap. That's why that carve out is there.
God.
So it's absolutely in the. It's fascinating. It's absolutely in the Congress's authority to do what they're doing. Full stop. I keep hearing these conversations on television, online, and everywhere else with, oh, they can't do this. Yes, they can. If you don't like it, vote them out. By the way, the Democratic majority part of their pitch last year, a huge part of their pitch was, right? Remember, it was, we will be a check on the president if you give us the majority. And that could include impeachment. Now, not every candidate who ran for the House emphasized the impeachment part as much, but we all knew that that was on the table, right? So the American people made their decision to put Trump in the executive office. Then they saw some things they didn't like, and there was a backlash, and then they decided, and the American people decided, to put a Democratic majority in the House. And so now this is what's happening. So when I see people like Alan Dershowitz, for example, say, and you've seen some of his stuff, Arnie, probably, when I see Dershowitz say things like, well, this just means that every president will be impeached from now on for political reasons.
Crap.
It could mean that. Well, here's the thing. That's probably crap. That's right. But it could be that. But this is exactly what the American people set the government up in motion to do, right, last year. They sent a Democratic majority to do things like this.
Exactly.
We'll see how it all shakes out, but it's kind of like, you know, they're set for this collision course, and we know the Republicans in the Senate are not going to vote to remove the president. That's, in all likelihood, is not going to happen. I guess we'll have to put, you know, some little caveat in there. Mm-hmm. In all likelihood, that's not going to happen. But just watch when this moves over to the Senate and there's a trial. It will be the Democrats complaining that the way the rules are set up by the Republican majority are not fair.
Well, here's the good news.
Because again, the Senate gets to decide how they're going to do that. It may be that they do, you know, a one day quick thing where they just vote to reject it, or it could be that they have a long trial. We'll all find out together.
So, yesterday we did something we rarely do. Yesterday being Wednesday on my radio show, Ken Barnes and myself did something we rarely do. We decided rather than having a guest at 12:30, we decided to read the preface to the report that was issued by Adam Schiff. We only got through 4 pages of the preface because we were just talking so much. But I recommend – no. Adam Schiff did something really brilliant. What he did, everyone, is the preface is the cliff notes of what you're about to read in the statement. And then you have the executive summary, which is an expanded cliff notes. All he does is he keeps repeating and repeating and repeating and just adding more detail and adding more detail. And if you just read the preface, it's only like 7 pages long. You will learn so damn much. But listen to this one thing that I thought was absolutely fascinating. When I think of Donald Trump all the time, what do I think about? I think that he really wants to be king. He really does. That's the way he views power. He thinks, l'état, c'est moi. I am the state is me. Okay, that's how he operates. And one of the things that Adam Schiff tells us in the preface, which is just amazing, is that the framers adopted a tool used by the British Parliament for several hundred years to constrain the crown. Here's the problem. It was called the powers of impeachment. But in England, you could impeach everyone but the king.
Right.
Okay, but the king. And therefore, you can sort of remove all the people around him, yada, yada, yada. But you could never quite get to the king because he was, l'état, c'est moi. But now...
Well, he was the law.
He was the law. But now what we understood was that's why we didn't want a king. That's why we wanted a president. That's why the president is exactly the person that would be targeted for the purposes of impeachment because we learned so much from the king. The problem is we now have a Republican Party that has anointed Donald Trump as a king and not a president. And so they're both sort of feeding off the same trough.
And it's for extraordinary circumstances. The powers of impeachment are sort of like the break glass if necessary.
Yes.
There's an emergency provision in the Constitution. And it's what the Democrats are moving forward with. Who gets punished by this politically? We'll see, but it is a political decision, right? And one other thing that I would add about this is that this whole deal with Ukraine, so interesting. By the way, Arnie, to your point, this discussion right now of whether the president has the same sort of powers as a king,
right?
That's where we're at in America right now.
We are. Exactly.
This is the discussion. This is the discussion
it's
we're
so
having.
So amazing.
In England, the king was the law. In the United States, the founders laid it out such that the law would be king. That's the whole idea. One other thing about this, you know, abuse of power. This is particularly ironic, coming from those who are so angry about foreigners coming over the Mexican border. You know, we've got to build that wall along the Texas-Mexico border so that they can't come in, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was put in the Constitution that, did you know this, Arnie?
Mm-mm.
The reason that the president has to be a natural-born citizen is because the framers feared foreign intervention in our politics.
Oh, you're kidding.
That was the whole point. Right. That, you know, and so this whole discussion, you know, here you have Trump, who was the birther, who kept claiming that, you know, Obama was not born in the United States.
So he couldn't be president.
And that's how he became, you know, any sort of a political force. That was his first big issue that he sort of, you know, rode to popularity within the Republican Party on. What he's accused of in Ukraine, what he admits to in this memo from the White House, is that he was inviting foreign intervention in our elections. And the idea that, the argument is, we're so close to the election, let the American people decide. Well, the accusation is that he's trying to cheat to win that election.
Well, here's the problem. There's a sense that somebody cheated in 2016 with support from Russia. And now what we're doing is we're finding out that he wants to cheat again. So I think the problem is, if you're going to continue to cheat, then what's the point of having an election?
Yeah, who cares?
Okay, the system is rigged.
Cancel the elections.
Right, exactly. The system. The system is rigged. And when you rig an election, you destroy a democracy. And the problem is that we're already rigging the election internally with the kind of money and dark money and everything else we're doing. Think about this. Now we are not only suppressing the vote, not only are we allowing all dark money in, now are we seeing billionaires trying to buy elections, but now we are inviting Putin and Ukraine and everybody to sort of participate in our election. I mean, what's the point? I mean, what they are ultimately doing is destroying the whole purpose of a democracy, where we get to decide our leaders and we get to make a choice. And now we got money getting involved in it. Now we have foreign, you know, countries getting involved in it. And Donald Trump, to a sad extent, is only sort of adding to, I think, a sense of unhappiness anyway about our elections. Mm-hmm. I mean, look what we say about gerrymandering. Gerrymandering is about politicians picking their voters as opposed to having voters pick their politicians. Mm-hmm. We already know so many destructive things are happening to our elections. This, I feel like, is the cherry on the sundae.
Well, politically, you know, if you think about the way that the Democrats are hitting the gas on this, as you mentioned, the Speaker saying go ahead and draft the articles of impeachment, they may be on track to vote on that in the House.
This weekend.
Really quickly. Just within days.
Yeah.
There's two things going on at once, right? I mean, they do want to sort of wound the president politically with this. I think that is part of it. No matter what the rest of the merits are, that, you know, that there's an attack going on for sure. But I do think that Democrats want to move through quickly with this because they don't want the entire campaign in 2020 to be about it. They'd like it to be part of it.
Yes.
As like they check that box that they voted to impeach Trump, but then they move on. Because as you said at the beginning, the top issues for the Democrats are not impeachment, even though it's pretty important to the Democratic base, I know. But, you know, top issues are what? Health care, equal rights for women, voting rights, climate change, those sorts of things, right? So they want to get back to talking about those things. One of the moments that was emblematic, I thought, you remember when the Democrats were having the Democrats running for president were having an event in Las Vegas and they were talking about gun violence. It was the same day that Pelosi moved forward with the impeachment inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a senior Republican in Texas tell me privately that he said, you know, he was sort of giddy about it because he said, you know, the Democrats are spanking us. Spanking the Republicans when it came to guns, and they couldn't help themselves. They had to switch the subject to something else.
God, this whole thing is getting just complete. But I think the idea that she pulled the trigger so quickly, the Republicans knew that it was going to happen quickly. I don't think they thought it was going to happen in 12 hours. I think that's a little bit of a shock because they now have to really quickly figure out what to do. And she really wants to send it over to the Senate. So the senators are on the record. That's what she wants. She wants a record for the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And
they just want the vote. So they can make it part of the campaign.
All right. So this is interesting. You sent me a message this morning. A suburban Republican is forced to retire from the Texas House after he said his GOP primary opponents are running against him because they are Asian.
Yeah. So Fort Bend County outside Houston, as we've talked about, is the most ethnically diverse county in the United States, a suburban county in southeast Texas. It's pretty close to where I grew up, Arnie. When I was a kid, a lot of that was farmland and mostly white people. Now it is the most ethnically diverse county in the U.S., and you have a Republican Texas House member, Rick Miller, who would have been running for his fifth term in the Texas House, going on a decade in that legislative body. He was interviewed by the Houston Chronicle, and it was just a basic sort of interview about, you know, your race and why are you running again and that sort of thing. And one of the things that he said to the reporter was that two of the GOP challengers who are running against him are running in that race, are running because they're Asian. And he told the Houston Chronicle that he felt it. Wait for it, Arnie. He told the Houston Chronicle, and by the way, that in and of itself could have been explained away as sort of a political strategy comment. Like, look, this is an area where a lot of Republicans are Asians, and they may want that kind of representation. But the next thing he said was, I think it's kind of racist that they're running against me. He's a white guy. And so there was outrage over this immediately. Within one day, Miller had to say he was not going to seek re-election to the House. Those Asians who were running against him, they said, one of them, who's, by the way, is a former GOP county chairman, who's pretty conservative, said, basically, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but he said, look, I'm running because, you know, I'm a conservative, and I believe that our community needs conservative representation in the Texas House. Now, this is one of the areas that we've talked about before, Arnie, which is the new battleground for Texas. It's the suburbs that are the melting pot, and this proves the point. If he had said basically the same thing or a version of it in East Texas, I don't think he would have been punished for it. He'd probably be rewarded for it by Republican primary voters. But there would be, but here's the other thing. There'd be no need to say anything like that in East Texas. There wouldn't be anybody that he could, you know, come up with saying, oh, they're running because they're a minority. Right. That would not be the case in places like that.
Right.
So it just wouldn't happen. It's all about the changing face of the suburbs in this area. The Democrats, of course, seized on this and said, you know, that they want to, you know, continue to make sure people in that area know what their now what's going to be their former representative had to say about minorities. But this is going to be fascinating. You do have a primary shaping up there. And we have a situation where only 9 seats are needed to be taken by Democrats to take the majority in the Texas House. And in the suburbs, places like this, where you have a meltdown happen in the last 48 hours,
right?
This is where it's going to be decided.
You know, it's so interesting. As I was reading this, I went back to in 1992 when I was the first woman to win the nomination for governor. I was running against the former attorney general for Governor Sununu, a guy named Steve Merrill. And there was a Libertarian candidate named Miriam Luce who had won the Libertarian nomination. So there was always two women and one guy on the stage. And Steve would over and over again sort of kind of play the idea that you had to feel for him because he was the only male on the stage. And I'm thinking, this is the first time there were ever females on the stage. And suddenly he insisted that the Libertarian always appears so it would be two against one. So everybody would feel sorry for the, you know, the white male on the stage. And historically, up until 1992, it had been all white men. You know, you just kind of look at these people going, these are classic, but oh my God, what are they doing? All right, really quickly before I let you go, I do need to ask you the question about Beto, because, you know, Beto has said he's not going to run for the U.S. Senate, but yet it appears that the polling is suggesting that he could probably pull this off, at least from a Democratic nomination.
Oh, he absolutely would. I mean, you have the Beto supporters who are desperately trying to, you know, they've got only a few days left. The filing deadline in Texas is December 9th, so that's Monday. They're desperately trying to get him to sign up to run for the U.S. Senate against John Cornyn. They put out a poll that showed that he would clear the field on the Democratic side. By the way, we've got, you know, 6 or 7 Democrats who are, one's a state senator, one's a city councilwoman from Houston, one's a workers' rights advocate. People who are not known across the state, Arnie, you know, people who, if you poll Democrats, they're polling at 1 and 2%, you know, 9%, I think some of them top out at. They're just not known. It takes a long time to get known in Texas. It's a state of 30 million people, just about. And so there is this effort going on to recruit Beto. I don't think that he's going to get in. No predictions, of course, but because who knows. But what he's really been focused on is trying to flip the Texas House. He's been out there campaigning for some of the Democrats. There was a special election in Fort Bend County, which we were just talking about, and O'Rourke was block walking for the Democrat who's running for that Texas House seat. He knows what you know. Two things true at once. Yep. I think Texas stays in the red column for the presidential race. That's probably the case, but that doesn't mean that the Texas House can't turn Democratic. In fact, the president's so polarizing that he could actually do better than the 9% win that he got last time in 2016, but the same sort of backlash in the suburbs could mean that a lot of those Democrats, those Republicans, just can't win their races in some places.
Okay, I got 1 minute. So let me quickly say that if Beto decides, because of, you know, the swell of public support, that on Monday he will file for the U.S. Senate, one of the things we did find last time he ran, when he ran against Ted Cruz, is that he swept a lot of Democrats in. So if he really wants to help the Texas House, if he really wants to help, you know, down ticket, he runs. Because he, in a lot of ways, he has coattails. He may not become the U.S. Senator. He might become the U.S. Senator. But what we definitely know is that there's a synergistic effect between the enthusiasm for him, what happens to Democrats, his ability to lead, his ability to garner passion and support in Texas. That's a way he can help down ticket.
Just maybe. The down ticket, the Texas House appears like fifth or sixth on the ballot, and we don't have straight ticket voting anymore, so
right.
Might actually do more good to just go to the individual districts and help those folks.
All right, and on that note, Scott Braddock, the voice of Texas, the editor of the Quorum Report, thank you so much, and I love the conversation we had about impeachment because it was really edifying. Thank you so much. Talk to you next week, Joe.
Thanks, Ernie.
All right, stick around, everyone. We're going to do a little bit about solar panels. Oh, you know me. I'm passionate about climate crisis. Stick around. We'll be right back.
When sealing your driveway is not really sealing it at all. On this current cast. Driveways and parking lots are coated with a sealant to protect them. But the coating needs to be reapplied every 2 to 3 years because driving on it grinds it into dust. And as it wears off, it could be polluting the water.
That dust is washed by the rain down into our gutters, tracked into the nearby soil, stormwater ponds, streams, lakes, rivers.
That's Cheryl Callio of the nonprofit Freshwater Future. She says the dust is a problem for fish and mammals because many common asphalt sealants contain coal tar, which includes compounds known to harm aquatic animals. But safer alternatives exist, so many communities have banned the use of coal tar sealants. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott. All right, so you know that I am passionate about issues of the climate crisis, and that despite the fact that we have the 2020 candidates who on occasion do talk about climate, and despite the fact that we have the impeachment, there is one issue I love to sort of focus on over and over again, and that is not only what is happening to our planet, but there are ways for us to begin to address it, and we need to move quickly and swiftly. And so I talk a lot about solar and wind. I actually spent a lot of time talking about batteries, which is about energy storage. In fact, I have a great interview with a guy next week about batteries and storage. But I went to Grist, and I saw two articles by Maria Gallucci. And the first article was like, whoa, this is kind of funky. It was entitled, No Land, No Problem. Floating solar panels might be the next big thing. And you start your piece, Maria, by taking us to New Jersey, of all places, and you take us to a blue lagoon. And on top of this blue lagoon is some solar panels. So give me a little bit of sort of this history of floating solar panels. How long have they been in existence? How do they operate? And why is this a success strategy that we should all be paying more attention to? Welcome to the program.
Sure. Thank you for having me. Well, so floating solar arrays, the first projects really began to appear in 2007 in Japan, actually. And a lot of the projects worldwide have developed in East Asia in particular because these are areas that don't have – either they don't have a lot of land or they have very dense urban environments, and so they have constraints in that way. And so floating solar panels, essentially, it's the same technology as we see on land, but the racking systems, the mounting systems are different, and they kind of can lock together like Lego pieces on water. And the idea is to take these hydropower dam reservoirs or retention ponds or quarry lakes, areas that aren't being used by people or aren't necessarily protected ecosystems, and put solar panels on those places. And so how it began in New Jersey is the water district in Sayreville, which is a borough just south of New York City, had wanted to build a solar project to offset their ample electricity use at the water treatment plant. Mm-hmm. But their treatment plant is surrounded by 400 acres of forest, and they realized to build a traditional solar plant, they'd have to cut down a lot of trees. And so they found out a kind of a solution was to put the panels on the retention pond instead.
It's such a win-win because you don't want to cut down trees at a time where we're talking about planting trees for carbon capture. And at the same time, they already have this space that's basically unused. And so the idea of putting these panels on it. So let's go back a little bit before we get to the story of New Jersey. And so you told me that, you know, this concept started in 2007 in Japan. There's the largest project, a 70-megawatt system, was developed by a French company in China. So that means that we do have some empirical data. We do have some history of their success. So what do we know from the panels that have been in existence since 2007 on water and the bigger project in China? What have we learned from that? Tell me a little bit about how do they float? What about stability? What about weather? What does it produce by having this covering over these, you know, relatively large, you know, water systems, whether it's a dam facility or whatever, or even a swamp? So I'm kind of curious, what have we learned from what we have seen already? Because we have at least a decade worth of information. And why does that mean that we should really be more nimble in considering it going into the future?
Sure. Well, I think what the data have showed so far from the kind of decade or so of projects in operation, there does seem to be evidence that having the solar panels create this cover can have a lot of what they call co-benefits. So
right.
Perhaps limiting the growth of toxic bacteria on the surface of water, potentially cooling the water temperature, and in doing so, preventing the panels from overheating, which when panels overheat, they operate less efficiently.
Exactly.
They produce less electricity. So that's one potential benefit, as well as reducing evaporation, again, by keeping the water temperatures cool, providing that cover. But I do think even though, you know, there's been over a decade worth of data, from the researchers I spoke to, there's a sense that it's still sort of early in the process. We're still understanding how these co-benefits work together. how the systems operate. The French company that you mentioned, Ciel Inter, they are currently in R&D to develop systems that can better withstand colder environments. So think, the upper Midwest in Minnesota, where there might be large quarry lakes or mining ponds, but harsh winters with lots of snow. So those are systems that they're still developing, because a lot of what we've seen so far is operating in warmer climates. And in the project in New Jersey, for example, is another example of where they're sort of learning as they go. There was some challenges related to mooring the structure, so making sure it doesn't drift away or kind of splash around in the water. They had to sort of devise a new system unique to that project for getting it locked in place.
But the other thing that you also mentioned is it's obviously more expensive. So because there are other – because you have to facilitate it on the water, because you have to moor it down, all that kind of stuff. But I guess what the group in New Jersey did was they did the sort of cost-benefit analysis. And when they realized how much energy they were using, they were looking at this location that seemed to be relatively perfect for what they needed, that they were able to not only use it for their sewage treatment, but that they would have excess capacity and they could then put it back on the grid. So when they sort of combined all the costs, it turns out to be kind of a win-win.
Exactly. And New Jersey has a program called the Solar Renewable Energy Credit Program, which has really helped spur a lot of solar development across the state, not just floating solar, but, rooftop on the ground. And so in that way, for all the electricity that project produces, the developers earn credits, and that helps offset some of those, as you mentioned, the higher costs associated with installing a floating solar array.
All right. And then I got two more things. One, you also mentioned that this might be considered by a lot of farmers who, because of irrigation purposes, need to make sure that their fields are flooded. But obviously, because of drought and drought issues, they're really trying to conserve and protect as much of the water reserves that they have. That if they were able to put these solar panels on top of some of those water supplies that they're using for their fields, this could be a win-win. They could be producing energy, but at the same time, making sure that evaporation isn't affecting their water and the necessity of their water for their fields. So in an interesting way, they're actually benefiting twice. I mean, no matter what happens, they don't want it to evaporate. Well, that's a win. And then on top of that, what's preventing them from not evaporating is they're producing energy. And that could, be fantastic for their farm. So I would really love to see how this would be a conversation with a lot of the agricultural community around the country. But your last line I thought was absolutely fabulous. And you write, what's the biggest hurdle? The biggest hurdle so far in the United States has been the fear of being first. Oy vey. It's just
exactly.
So depressing.
And that's why I think, as you mentioned, the quote is from a developer who's hoping that this project that I wrote about in New Jersey, because it's the largest in North America, could get a lot of attention, could get a lot more people inspired and consider adopting similar projects.
So before we go on to the other topic, I do want to share something. As I'm reading this and I'm thinking about these, places where you could be floating these things, there is something called the Berkeley Pit. Are you familiar with this? The Berkeley Pit is a former open pit copper mine located in Butte, Montana. It is 1 mile long by a half mile wide. And here's the problem. It is so heavily acidic that birds that land on it die. Now, I am thinking of that place, and I'm thinking, if they could figure out a way to protect the solar panels from the acid, that would be an amazing location for a floating solar panels, because nothing survives there. It is literally a dead lake. Oh, my God. And as I'm reading your story, I'm going, call Butte, Montana. Let them try to figure this out. I'd love them to be the next second largest in the United States. What's the fear anymore? They've got a dead lake. Let's try to figure out a way of using it. So I just want to let you know, it's a fabulous, fabulous piece. And I think that as we're coming to grips with the climate crisis, there'll be less fear and more willing to sort of accept the idea that this could possibly work. Now, the other piece that you had, I posted on Facebook, and it was because I wanted people in my state to begin to realize that one of the biggest, I think, sort of sense of reluctance to embrace alternative energy is that poor and middle-class people, and I mean lower middle-class people, begin to think that this is only for the elite, that the elite get to do the geothermal in their back 40, that the elite get to put solar panels on their roof, that the elite get to do yada, yada, yada. And you tell a wonderful story about energy equity, about bringing solar power to low-income communities. I posted this on my Facebook page, and I said, attention, members of the New Hampshire legislature, attention, people who are running for governor. This is a win-win for people in the northern part of my state for a couple of reasons, but the most important is they have very little in the way of economic opportunity. They have incredibly high cost of living, and this could be a way for them to really buy into alternative energy, but also make where they live more affordable. Tell my audience about these low-income community strategies, which I think are just fabulous.
Sure. Well, and so I started writing this piece, and it originally appeared in Yale Environment 360, looking at community solar, how it was kind of booming relative to other segments of the U.S. solar industry. And I saw that, the idea of community solar is that you have one array and multiple people can either own or lease shares of the project and then receive sort of the cost savings that come with selling solar electricity to the grid.
Right.
But the challenge that a lot of projects or a lot of states were seeing is that the folks who were participating tended to be, from government agencies or large businesses or higher earning households. And so to moderate income folks were not kind of getting these cost savings. They weren't participating. So about a dozen states and Washington, D.C. made a concerted effort to start including more people and making sure that these sort of the promise of renewable energy actually could reach everybody. As you mentioned, part of the title is energy equity.
Yeah.
So some of the challenges for accessing even community solar projects is they might still have upfront costs, right. The participation fees can still total tens of thousands of dollars, or there can be very steep monthly subscription fees, which could be offset with solar savings, but you need to have that cash on hand to even get involved. So some of these programs will waive those costs through grants, or they will find other ways, even, credit scores have kept some people from participating. So there are projects where they waive credit checks. Just to make sure these sort of financial barriers don't prevent more people from participating.
So let me just say something. Many, many years ago, I had a friend who worked for one of the Vermont utilities, and he left the utility. And one of the reasons he left the utility was he wanted to go into something that was kind of a variation on your theme. And what he wanted to do was he wanted to package all the utilities that were going into a different business or a different house and say, I will figure out a way for you not only to use alternatives, but to make it cheaper in the long run. And the way you pay me back is by what you save. So as I'm looking at your story, I want to start by just reading a couple of sentences, if that's okay with you. You have Izzy Palins lives in a small cabin nestled among mountain peaks and towering trees in the Colorado Rockies. Her home is often shaded and during the long winters buried under heaps of snow. Her monthly utility bills show credits for solar electricity production, but there are no solar panels affixed to her roof. Instead, the power comes from a solar array some 60 miles away in a nearby valley. Last year, the panels nearly slashed her energy bill in half. And she writes, I've been thrilled, she says. A 76-year-old retired waitress who relies partly on Social Security benefits to make her ends meet. And what you find out is this is a way of bringing not only alternative energy to these low-income communities, it's also about changing their quality of life. Because if you can save, half your energy costs by participating in this, one, you have some money to pay in, but two, you still have residue savings, which means you can actually live in a better environment because it's a win-win strategy. That's what I loved about this. And so my question to you is, as you were writing this story, is one of the ways for them to pay in based on their savings? So if I save $10, I give you $2.
Oh, that's an interesting I'm not actually sure in terms of, so you're saying that they're kind of paying it forward in a way with anticipated savings?
Right, exactly. So that what I'm, so, in a lot of ways people say, okay, I'll waive your entrance fee or I'll waive your participation fee. Well, I would rather feel like I could make sure that there would be someone else to participate next. And one of the ways of doing it is saying, okay, thank you for waiving the entrance fee, but the participation fee take a piece of what I'm saving and make that my participation fee. But make sure that in the end, I get the $8 and you get the $2. So we do it in such a way that you're doing is you're staggering the payback, but you're doing it in a way that you're ensuring that you're paying it back so somebody else can participate. And when my friend was suggesting this, I'm going, this is freaking genius. But I think this is one of the ways that you can get relatively poorer communities to even consider doing this because they can't waive, but they could stretch out the cost of participation. And that to me is a win-win. And it's also a win-win because I really want to see people see alternative energy not only as good for the climate, but good for the quality of their lives.
Yeah, that's a very, and that's a great idea. And it may even be in place in some of these
right.
programs. There are dozens, maybe hundreds of community solar programs across the country, which is so interesting because a lot of them are also designed to serve the communities in unique ways. And I think some of the better projects are really, there's a lot of community participation and they're kind of catered to the local environment rather than just sort of a one-size-fits-all project.
Tell everyone a little bit about what the District of Columbia has developed. Again, you know, you're thinking of this in the rural area. Well, the District of Columbia is Washington, D.C., and yet they recognize that they, you know, they may have a lot of elite people living there, but basically the people that live there 24/7 are not. And again, because of density issues, it is very difficult to do solar. In part, also, you don't own anything. You rent. So how do you participate in a solar project when ownership isn't your issue? That, I guess, is kind of interesting for me is how do you participate when you're a renter and not an owner?
Right, and that's an issue that I think it's something like 44% of all U.S. Households or all Americans in the U.S. Cannot participate in traditional solar projects because they either don't own their house, they don't have suitable rooftops, maybe, you know, they're shaded by trees, or they're not in a financial situation to participate. So that's hundreds, over 100 million people who can't participate, but that's what these community solar projects are aiming to solve. And you mentioned the project in Washington, D.C. They have a Solar for All program that's providing something like $13 million in grants to help 100,000 low-income households reduce their energy bills, including through community solar projects.
Well, and then this one, this is definitely up my alley. You talk about a project called Groundswell. So tell everybody what Groundswell is, which is a nonprofit community solar developer. But they have an issue. They have an interesting target for where they go with their solar panels.
Yeah, they've been working with different houses of worship, so various churches, synagogues, places like that, and one of the projects that they worked on, actually, the church, they wanted to put rooftop solar panels on their facility for their own sort of cost-saving benefits. But they realized that one way to serve their community, which is part of their sort of mission as a faith organization, was to allow residents to participate, to subscribe and receive those benefits as well. So it is interesting. Renewable energy, in a way, became part of their larger faith mission.
Well, so I'm going to go back to 2009. In 2009, I think I was one of the first houses in Concord to put solar panels on her roof. And I have an 1890 Queen Anne Victorian. And what you need to know is that I got so much grief. Oh, my God, you're going to harm your house. Look what you're going to do. It's going to be bad for the neighborhood. What are we going to do? You know, it was so funny. People's reaction was that I was not only going to sort of take away the value of my house by putting solar panels on, but then I was going to take away the value of other people's houses because I have this eyesore of solar panels on my house. And then, this is the worst part, Maria, is that I got attacked by the industry itself, not the solar industry, but the electricity industry, the utility, saying that I was being a rich snob because only rich people could afford to put solar panels on their roof. And so this was an elitist thing for me to do. That was 2009. Let me track you to 2019. 2019, there are solar panels everywhere in downtown Concord. They're on every house. Nobody sees it as an eyesore. Everybody sees it almost as a sign of success. The utility isn't saying that it's only for the privileged anymore. It is, to me, it's so interesting to see how, in some ways, how quickly things have changed. And and our sense of relationship and identity, and the idea of the groundswell where, you know, where churches and places of worship are now seeing the connection between what they can do for their church or their temple or their mosque, but also serve the community at the same time. It really does show that there is a growing sense of community when it comes to things like solar panels, where historically we saw them more as an individual resource. Now we're beginning to see that, you know, we may have the space, but we can actually connect other houses to what we are able to do because they don't necessarily have the ability to buy in. It's amazing.
Exactly. And it's more about how can we all participate, and rather than just the few people seeing benefits, how can we all benefit while also supporting renewable energy development, supporting, you know, mitigating greenhouse gas emissions and things that affect sort of way beyond our own community.
And you have at the very end, you write, on average, according to a recent study by researchers at Tufts University and the University of California, Black and Hispanic majority census tracts have significantly fewer rooftop solar projects than whites. Let me repeat that sentence. Black and Hispanic majority census tracts have significantly fewer rooftop solar projects than white. Majority or no, majority census tracts for low-income households in particular, says Tom Feigl, head of the community solar at Grid Alternatives in Oakland. The push for state and local community solar policies is needed to overcome the financial and technical hurdles that prevent more inclusive participation. We know the market won't serve these customers on their own, he said. That, to me, is the most powerful exclamation point on your piece at Grist, because I think this is part of the problem. We know the benefits. The benefits aren't only to our climate crisis. The benefits aren't only to what we're able to do for our utility bills. But the people that are struggling with their utility bills, eating sometimes 10, 20, and 30% of their income, who have the lowest income, who could benefit the most from alternative energy, because it would slash those bills, are the least likely to do it. And that's when, you know, you love groundswell, you love the nonprofits, but this is really a screaming cry to states and local communities to say we got to step up because we have to share this benefit. It's not only good for the people in our community, it's essential for climate crisis.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the study that you mentioned by Tufts University and UC Berkeley was so interesting, and I wasn't really able to fully dive into it in the story, but it actually found that solar projects, as you mentioned, there's sort of this this racial or ethnic divide, and that's independent of income as well. So even in higher earning areas where they might have Black or Hispanic majority census tract, there's still fewer solar projects, and there's a whole host of reasons, but the sort of conclusion, as you mentioned, was that they're analysts or researchers are saying we need to be more deliberate about where we're building. So not just increase participation based on income, but also other demographic yes. factors, that we need to actually create policies that say this is our goal and this is how we'll achieve it.
So one last point, because I'm obviously crazy about this topic. And so one of the things I want to do is there's a program in education called Reading Recovery. And what does Reading Recovery do? It goes into the bottom 20% of readers. It focuses on those bottom 20% to make them better readers. So you don't have to be coded. You don't have to be, you know, some kid with, you know, quote unquote, a learning disability. You just have to be at the bottom of the pack when it comes to your reading ability. And they focus on you. I want to have something called energy recovery. I want to look at the sort of the 20% across the board, whether it's businesses or homes or whatever, and say, you obviously have a need. I want to help you. And start with that bottom 20%. And you don't care what the color is. You don't care what the income is. You don't care whatever it is. And you really sort of surge and make your investment there. If in some ways that we do that generically, ironically, what we will do is go into poorer communities. We may, in fact, go into communities that are, you know, predominantly Hispanic or Black. And what we've done is we've done a win-win strategy. We've been blind. What we haven't been blind to is that they are really consuming more energy than they should. They need efficiency. They need alternatives. And we can then address that. And it would be so interesting if we could do an energy recovery just the way they did the reading recovery, because it's turned out to be a success strategy in education. It could be an amazing success strategy in energy. So that's why I love these topics. Thank you so much for writing this stuff at Grist. You've been absolutely fabulous. And I will make sure that I keep following the climate desk. Maria Gallucci wrote a piece entitled Energy Equity, Bringing Solar Power to Low-Income Communities. It is an important story, not just for those of us who care about climate. It's an important story if we care about the sort of grotesque inequality between folks. And this is a way of making a difference. It's a win-win for all of us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. All right, everyone, this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Talk to you next week. You've been